Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Andy Boyd. My guest on the program today is Lisa B. Thompson, author of a new collection of three plays out from Northwestern University Press, Underground, Monroe, and The Momologues. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I am so happy to be chatting with you.
I'd love the opportunity to say the monologue or the Momologues out loud. I feel like that's just one of those inspired titles.
Thank you. A lot of people, I've had mixed responses to it, but it really fits, I think, the style of the play, and also kind of a tongue-in-cheek nod to the vagina monologues, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's certainly in that lineage, for sure. Yeah. Could you tell us a bit about your background and how you started writing plays?
That's a good question. My background is I was born and raised in San Francisco among migrants from the South to California, and the big storytellers. And I think that I fell in love with story and narrative from being read to at night. My mom would read to my brother and I. And then one day we were hanging out a rainy day and decided to write stories. And I've been writing ever since. That was probably, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old. And continue to do that. Deciding going from poetry, short stories to poetry, and then theater kind of became the place to land completely because it spoke to all of my, creative juices, where I like to create characters and also worlds completely, and also like to watch people perform live. So that's probably what probably the sense of that. I also remember going to the opera with my mom at San Francisco and thinking about like our different, live performance, and thinking how amazing that is to see people right that close to you. But encompassing a different world.
There's also a real musicality to your plays, not just because each one of them comes with a pre-show playlist, but but just the sense of the musicality of the dialogue. It flows very naturally, and you have a great way of establishing character through really specific dialogue. All your characters sound distinct and unique and individual. Do you feel like that was part of what drew you to plays, that kind of adjacent to music nature of theater?
I'm actually dying to write a musical at some point. I feel that it's important to me that each character has its own unique voice, and that those voices are ones that I haven't seen on stage very often or very much. People that I grew up listening to, my parents' friends, my aunts and uncles, my cousins, my friends in school. And I want to do more of that. And actually, it's hopefully get to the point where I'm also representing the next play I'm working on, Gold, which is part of my Great Migration trilogy, which begins with Monroe. And Gold is set in San Francisco in the 1970s. And maybe it's a way for me to kind of capture the world I lived in, which was broader than just the African-American migrant community in the Bay Area, but also my best friend from El Salvador and my other friends from the Philippines, and really diverse working class community that I grew up in. So yeah, those voices are important, I think, for people to hear and understand. The worlds we put on stage sometimes don't really reflect all of our sensibility or sense of the world. And my charge right now is going to do more of that.
Yeah, that one thing that's very clear in your plays is that the African American community is really central. I mean, I'm not sure there's a character in these three plays that isn't Black. Was that something that you kind of consciously chose to do, that you wanted to represent your community in a way that it hadn't been seen before, or had rarely been seen on stage? Or was that just sort of the natural way to tell the stories that occurred to you?
Well, I think yes and no, that because there are is one white character in Monroe, which is Dr. Wyatt Weiland, who only appears in the beginning and was played in Austin by this fabulous actor, Huckabee. That's a great name. I think that the reason why, well, and also in the monologues, the three characters play a variety of people. So they morph into men, to white women, to all these other different folks. So those characters are unnamed but exist in the kind of the universe and the world of these characters. And I think that for me, the people I wanted to, the characters I wanted to create who dominate the work definitely are those that we rarely get a chance to see, I think, or hear from, even though they are, many of them are privileged Black folks.
Right. That's another thing I noticed in your plays, and I gather in your scholarly work as well, is there's a real focus on sort of middle class, professional class African-American people, which is, yeah, not the common, there's often a common kind of association between Blackness and poverty, but obviously those two things don't necessarily go together. Mm-hmm. So what do you feel like drew you to that specific kind of subsection of the African-American community?
Oh, I found it really fascinating that I grew up in San Francisco, and when I got to college, another Black woman from the same city lived on my floor, and finding out that she lived an entirely different world than I did, that she was a debutante. I remember her having a Laura Ashley comforter and matching pillow sham and also the matching wallpaper to go on her bulletin board. I didn't know what a pillow sham was or a comforter. I was happy to have a new bedspread. I thought that was, you know, I was living it up. And I remember, you know, she was a really wonderful person, but we lived in different worlds. And literally I lived on the other side of the tracks, which were the tracks in San Francisco are the BART tracks, which were put in and decimated the neighborhood that I grew up in. Actually, by the time I was aware of the world, those homes were all gone. My siblings talked about the other families that lived across the street from us. And by the time I came to consciousness, because BART starts in 1972, and I was, remember looking out, it was for a while kind of just this barren land that was being, you know, developed for BART, and then BART comes in. So I guess that, I don't know. I forgot what we're talking about.
So it started as you grew up in a more working class background, it originally was a sort of fascination with that lifestyle. But, you know, now you're a scholar of African American studies, and you've published multiple plays. Do you feel like you are at home among that milieu now, even though you didn't grow up in it, or do you still feel like it's a group that you're kind of on the outside looking in?
Both. I mean, so I think when someone experiences class ascension in their own lifetime, right? I'm a first generation college educated, and my parents were brilliant people, but did not have college degrees. So they did fit, you know, both. As they say, the term is did some college. My mother was very close to finishing and had transferred from City College, San Francisco, to San Francisco State. And I was really proud of her and supported her as she was working on toward that degree. And one of my sad things that I never was able to have her finish. I think she was very shy, maybe 20 credits from finishing. But she raised a daughter that went on to get her PhD from Stanford and was instrumental in all of my education from her, like I said, reading to us at night, but also taking me to the public library all the time. I remember going to the library with her and getting my the maximum was 14 books, and you know, pushing my load across the wooden desk, and a woman looking at me and seeing this little black girl and saying, you know, those are due in 2 weeks. I'm looking at her like, honey, I don't need 2 weeks. Just give me 6 days. They'll be done. I'll be back. You know, sit down. You know, and so it's interesting. Yeah. So I think I also want to talk about the desire of folks like my parents who want their children to have more access to intellectual stimulation and certain kind of lifestyle. But I've also had friends that remind me that I grew up with that said, you know, your family in our community was the middle class family that you had. You know, your father lived at home. You guys lived in a house and didn't rent. You had a car. You had all these things. So I also got a sense of how broad middle classness is, right? So I thought we were solidly middle class. I believed until I got to college and saw these other African American students who had different kind of lifestyles than and then going being at Stanford as a graduate student was really my first time teaching a course called the Black Middle Class, and having all these students who I think everyone's kind of performing a certain kind of racial authenticity, which means working class in terms of performance. And then spring break came. I remember they were talking. One was going to ski in Sweden, and the Swiss Alps, and another one going to the Caribbean, for a boating trip. And it was like, what are you going to do? All of a sudden, the whole performance is gone, and what are you doing for spring break? And until I got to Stanford, I never had been around that much wealth. I mean, UCLA, I went to undergrad at UCLA, the kind of wealth that I noticed among being black graduate students who had gone to Andover and Phillips, Academy, Exeter and what have you, mm-hmm. Definitely was interesting. And also found out that summer is not just, it's not just a noun, but it's also a verb, as in where do you
summer? Yeah, where do you, we summer on the cave.
Exactly. And do you see summer up in Saugatuck or summer in, on Sag Harbor or what have you. So that was a category. But also when you grow up in California, where are you going to go summer? You don't need to. You can go to the beaches, right? You're mm-hmm. the place. Everyone's coming to where you are to be in many ways. So that was also part of it. But I think that when you look at the African American middle class or the black middle class and see the ways in which they, despite all of following all of the rules, ticking off all the boxes, the kinds of if they're catching hell, then what are the less privileged encountering? And mm-hmm. I'm the person that's in the room that's going, wants to make sure that everybody's aware of that group, whether it's a room full of people who are third generation black people, college educated, but also when I'm often navigating school systems on behalf of my son that are not aware of how their policies would exclude me. So if I was matriculating now, I would not have the career that I have because the doors closed behind my generation, the ways in which affirmative action programs, I'm a proud affirmative action baby, changed the professional classes. I have good friends who are all first generation college educated, were part of the UC, University of California systems decision to bring in the top students in across the state and to make the University of California this beautiful jewel, crown jewel of the state, representative of all of the people who are citizens who pay into the taxes that help support, not completely support, but help support a public education. And so I had friends who were doctors and lawyers and dentists and executives who of my generation who would not be able to get into those schools now anyway. So there's that. And I always think, you know, being in all these different, you know, rooms, very clear once you're in those rooms and you're on the committees deciding certain things, that it is not about how I hate gifted and talented programs. You know, every child is gifted and talented if you give them a chance to enjoy their gifts. If they're worried about what they're going to eat, or right now for all the children who are not having access to internet, right, which should be a common good that is not no one needs to pay for. Right now, going around our city, there's buses, public buses that are going to school sites so people can have Wi-Fi. So can you imagine being in a car trying to do your homework or be in class because you're at home? I mean, so we're unwilling to have an honest conversation about what allowed me to get where I am was, you know, my mother figured out how to play the corners, as Jay-Z would say, right? Where the hustlers be, okay, here's a free summer program at Stern Grove in San Francisco for my kids to go to summer camp. Here's Penny Opera so they can get exposed to Leontine Price at the San Francisco Opera. It's used a public library system. My brother and I were eager. My older siblings, my parents had four kids in 14 years, so I'm the youngest of four. So my older siblings were already kind of out in the world, but my brother and I were 3 years apart, and we were hungry, and our careers seemed to reflect her ability to do those things. And literally, a woman was, I guess, sent to jail for using a different address to have her child go to a certain school. My mother did the same thing for us, is having borrowed an address so we can go to school in Daly City, which was a suburb south of San Francisco, right in the county. We're right there on the line. And our professional lives has played out in that way. So when people talk about, I'm sorry, I'm going to tear here.
This is all great.
Because I get really upset because I know education is everything. And even in the idea of good schools, I'm like, for African-American parents who are much like myself, who are my, you know, my peers who are, you know, also college educated, you really, your choice is between a school that is quote unquote a good school that is resourced but will not speak to Black Lives Matter, will not speak to, will only talk about King and some kind of cartoonish I Have a Dream thing while talking about how he was had a war on poverty, while he was talking about the war in Vietnam, that basically the ways in which our kids will not be, they're culturally and politically fed, but intellectually in a way that leads to a certain kind of SAT and GPA, but not kind of a whole citizen. Or you put your child in a school that's going to be culturally sound, but is under-resourced. So I see schools, and you know, people would be surprised to find out, I will ask you, do you have any idea what the most segregated school system is in Texas?
In Texas? You know, you're based in Austin. I'll guess Austin.
Travis County, which is Austin, which is seen as blue city in the red state. It's the most segregated. Right.
Well, New York is also one of the most segregated school districts in the country.
It is number one, actually. New York is number one. So, but in terms of Texas people, think, oh God, you know, it must be Dallas or whatever. So the liberal folks, you know, are maintaining and hoarding resources in order to maintain the class, their class position. And so that's why class is fascinating to me, is watching how people hoard resources, whether and maintain them, and have a sense of meritocracy at the same time. It's hilarious to me because I look at the schools here and know these stay-at-home moms with, you know, MBAs and JD who are able to fundraise and have these huge budgets for the PTA because they have the time, because, you know, it's just easier right now because, you know, with Jennifer and Josh at home, and then I'm like, okay, versus the family who's across town whose parents are doing our quote unquote essential laborers, right? Who are putting their lives on the line to make sure you can put gas into your Lexus and so what have you. So yes, I'm very fascinated with the way in which class is a open horror in American life, and I think about the ways in which African Americans navigate that too, and thinking if I follow the rules, then my life will be better, and it is better, but at what cost to one's soul, but also you still have to navigate all the institutional racism and in ways that, without having a community around you to back you up. So it's a, you know, so yeah, it's a, I can go on and on about that, but
no, that's great. So, I mean, getting back to the plays, I feel like this is one of the major themes of your play Underground, which is a two-hander featuring one character who was born into wealth, but kind of self-consciously styles himself as a working class Black advocate. And then you have another character who was born in South Central LA, but who sort of chases the status symbols of wealth and of mainstream acceptance. And he's a high-powered lawyer with this, you describe him having a beautiful turntable with a very expensive set of speakers and having, you know, great taste in wine, and he cooks healthy food and all of these kind of upper middle class signifiers. And yet he comes from this very working class background. Could you talk a little bit more about how you wanted to explore those themes in the context of this play in particular, Underground?
Oh, gosh. Underground came out of my experience living through the L.A. uprisings after the Rodney King verdict of the Simi Valley verdict of those policemen that beat him. And thinking about what it feels like to be in a state of emergency. And so this is, you know, predates what happened this year around George Floyd and others. So this play was... and also, I wanted to have a conversation or open conversation of what's really going to make the country change. If you put it in the hands of those, the most oftentimes those people who are on MSNBC or CNN or even Fox, the talking heads, are folks who are not living the same kinds of lives that of the folks that are often victimized by the police, right? The same way. My friend here, Louis Gates, of course, found himself on the wrong side of the law trying to get into his home. A lot of people thought that, oh, well, you know, good, let him experience that. And it's like, I was really disappointed in that sense of really, because I'm like, well, yeah. I would. Stanford, and so if this happened to me, you would laugh about it gleefully as well, because there's a perception that you have the life, so something to be asked to examine, I think, around that. So I wanted to play with what it means for someone to have class ascension and try to do things that are going to help change the status quo. And then someone who has lived a life of privilege and decides that he wants to change the status quo, but in some ways he becomes a star as in that way too, right? So he's not just it's in the play that no one's clean, I guess, is the and the hard truth is, will voting, and that's what people are debating about, something like voting for the right candidate, quote unquote, really change some of the insidious things. I think what happened in April was that we no longer can operate as if in our day-to-day lives people are not choosing to ignore. It's clear that that people are choosing to ignore the fact that we have systemic and long-standing inequality and kind of policies and institutional functions that maintain a racial hierarchy, and that pointing to my life, I always push back about this. Like, look what happened with you. It's like, I quote Willie Brown, who ran the legislature in California for many years. And he was actually the mentor to Kamala Harris. And so I saw him at a Silicon Valley. He gave a talk for, I think it was Black History Month. And I was also in the presenting that. And someone asked him, he said, people say to me all the time, hey, Willie, you know, look at you. You ran the California legislature, and you know, how can you say there's discrimination? And he said, well, look at, you know, my skill set. He said, if things were actually fair, Bill Clinton would be my chauffeur. it was hilarious, but also like, you know, so you right. look at, you know, some black excellence people point to, it's like, well, you know, for instance, we just watched the debates with Senator Harris and Vice President Pence. And for me, getting back to the question of, you know, what it means to decide how we're going to change this country. If we are all honest with ourselves, seriously honest with ourselves, I mean, look at Trump and we look at Pence and we look at Biden and we look at Harris. The only person that really belongs in that group is Harris.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really? Yeah. Young, vibrant, smart. I mean, all the things are there. It's like, what do you? So if we're talking about meritocracy, to me, it just seems like, are we really going to act like they're all equal? She's superior, far superior than all three of them. Well, you know, right. I mean, it's ridiculous. So that's what. So I understand when young people look at me and say, why should I vote? It's a charade. So this mm-hmm. the conversation, you know, hope people will read in Underground or hopefully produce, because it's only been produced once and people are saying, whoo, it's a little hot, too hot to touch, because it does deal with the idea of insurrection and protest in a way that we have not talked about in a long time. So I think that we need to have some more honest conversations and just be saying we're willing to donate to the Boys and Girls Club and to NAACP and these other things. But then I look at my son's school, nebulous person. I'm creating this kind of, you know, mock-up person. And I look at my child's school and don't see anybody of color there, except for a black judge's kid. And a engineer's kid and think that all is well in the world. And you, come on. I just say that I think we need to be also more open as a country about class and how it reproduces itself. My son is able to go to certain kinds of schools. It's not some kind of surprise, you know, the kind of access he has, right? The kind of summer enrichment I'm going to provide for him. Of course, I want to live in a world where the child that I was, who didn't have parents that can do that, is in the classroom with him. So he's not the only one, because that's not a prize. You get to be the only black kid. Although he was at a middle school with only six black kids. Out of, you know, hundreds. I mean, it's like, what do you?
Yeah.
People are complaining, like, oh my God, this year nobody can get in because they made it more representative, a tad more representative. I was like, it's gross. And I said, so you mean all the seats that were taken from that community for the last 30 years? You mean that's what you're complaining about? That those seats now went to, and again, talking about literally three more.
Jeez.
In the liberal city.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It does seem like there's that when it comes to the issue of schools, that's the moment where the sort of polite white liberal racism really comes to the surface. But everybody is everyone's a liberal until it affects them personally, right?
Yes. And that's why the monologues is the place where I really able to talk about what it means to navigate motherhood as a Black woman. And say all the things I wanted to say, you know, in the PTA meetings or what have you, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
let's talk about that play. I'm so interested in the question of audience. I've been talking about this with a lot of the playwrights I've interviewed on this show. And, you know, it's the question of whether are you writing just for your own community or are you writing to express something about your community to kind of some imagined, probably white, neutral theater goer. Do you feel like was the monologues a play that you wrote kind of to be written by you as a Black woman for other Black women, especially Black mothers who share some of these experiences? Or do you feel like you're trying to kind of create a bridge to people who don't have those experiences to help them understand what it's like to live in your shoes?
Well, I think as an unpartnered mother, I think that Black mother, I am talking to everyone, doing it all to get through my day, I have to do 800 things to keep all the balls in the air. So I want to speak to I want to make Black middle-class single motherhood intelligible to other mm-hmm. people, but I also want to send a shout out to those other moms of my mothers who I know and love and who friends of mine who are engineers and lawyers who are happen to be single parents and doing, you know, amazing jobs, but are constantly unintelligible to whoever they, so if they end up at the, you know, at the dog park or whatever, people are like, what are you doing here on a Tuesday at 3 o'clock, you know, or 2 o'clock, right? Or sorry, 11 a.m., right? So how are you, mm-hmm. are you a nanny? Or the being among working class women and realizing that your class privilege is showing, right? You know, that, you know, so that's, you know, to the Black middle class moms, and also definitely addressing what it means to help your child navigate the educational system that you've been able to successfully navigate. So you know the horrors that are there for them to have to work through. So it's also for Black middle class mothers, particularly single mothers, to be able to feel like, okay, I'm not crazy for having these feelings or experiences. But also some of the moms that I knew from my son's elementary school years came to the show and were like, oh my God, you know, like, you know, it was delightful. And it was actually, you know, and some that I didn't necessarily hang out with, but, you know, they did a mom's night and I guess they didn't know what they were going to be getting. And I was also happy though to have my son's principal there who was a black woman. She's gone on to do another a higher position in the school district who was navigating this magnet school as a leader that had literally in its walls, and it happens in more than one school in Austin, where you have the most privileged people in the city and some of the least. And they're separated by the magnet group. And then there's the academy group. I remember as a child myself, I remember that there was tracking and they were the early birds and the late birds. And, you know, it's kind of think about the idea of like, what means to be an early bird and a late bird, you know, and it's supposed to be innocuous terms that actually you look back on as you grow older, like, oh my God, how horrific, you know, who, you know, the quote unquote smart kids. And the monologues is also about the absurdity of all of it as well, the day-to-day, you know, living and navigating.
Yeah, that play felt of the three, both the most personal and the most absurd.
Yes. I mean, and so I think I love, just like my first play, Single Black Female, is very similar to that in style in terms of giving actresses, especially mature Black women, access to performing all these different kinds of people, from, you know, a Baptist preacher to a 12-year-old soccer phenom to, you know, to, I mean, you know, just all mm-hmm. the, So I love that part of it. But that's also how I kind of imagine and deal with the world, is like all the voices and all the different kind of circumstances of my life all come together at once. And I want to, in these moments, you're trying to just basically go get groceries, but then you're in a moment of confrontation with sometimes with I'll call it a racial moment, where you're like, and really at that moment you're just trying to get your your almond milk. You're not really trying to have a moment with somebody about or you're flying somewhere and you're like, you're happy you made the plane, you're just, happily falling into your seat, and then the person actually sees you with your laptop or whatever you're doing and wants to now find out what you do for a living, and basically I call it talking bear syndrome, of people like, well, oh my good, you teach at the universe and you do, oh, and they always, and for some reason white people always ask, and do you teach graduate students, as if, no, they don't allow me to do that, that's the line they draw, that's I can't. And so it's like hilarious, and it's like, so, and then looking at, and they find out, then they they start asking you where you went to school, and then it's like, oh my god, I've been around bears before, but you're a talking bear, I'm so, this is amazing, you're really, honey, a talking bear, come see. I mean, so I'm starting to think, I start lying to people because, like, I don't owe you my biography. Who are you? You're a lady on the plane. I mean, what? And it's a sense of, and so what's been striking about the moment with, I guess the racial awakening for many white people that happened this spring in the George Floyd moment, the Breonna Taylor moment, it's, and I'm like, and the white friends, well meaning, but it's like, you want to send me, bring cookies over. And it's like, well, where were the cookies? I wanted cookies when Tamir Rice died. Where were you? Mm-hmm. Where were you when Rodney King was beaten? I've been watching this my entire life. And you're showing up in 2020 with cookies? I don't.
Yeah. I wonder, why do you think, I mean, I guess I'm sort of asking you to interpret the whites for our audience, but why do you think it was this year? Why this year and not, the first wave of Black Lives Matter protests in 2015, 2016? Why wasn't it any of these other moments until this year that kind of brought, like, the average, not particularly political white person out in the streets for the first time?
They were home. The world was paused.
And nothing else to do.
And to look at yourself, I mean, a lot of people are having a lot of awakenings during this moment, being, quiet with oneself and having to be. So that's one of the things. I think that younger students, I remember when the election of Trump happened, watching a coalition of hundreds of UT students marching the next morning, trans students, white students, black students, Latino, Asian, South Asian, cross age and gender, and I remember being on the news. I heard the marching, and I came outside and gave them the Black Power fist that day. And so I think that part of it is that generation, they've been paying attention to different kind of art and different kinds of conversations. That's part of it. They're pushing their parents, but the people that are my or contemporaries age wise. I think that the big shift between Obama and Trump has made them, it was whiplash, and I think it's important that they're probably having to, I hope, realize their own complicity in maintaining the status quo, because I mean, how many people are on boards that look, everybody looks the same? They don't know. I mean, it's just. There's no one's hands are clean unless you're in the streets and upending these things, and we'll see how long. Everybody had a post on their website, every business, but how have your hiring practices changed? You've gotten rid of Aunt Jemima's, but what are you going to do about who's not just the CEO, but how are you treating the least powerful workers? It's just so much has to be done, so that that brings us back to underground, which is what's really going to change that, because we have people now in Hollywood, these white male former showrunners and directors, feeling like, and it's so impossible for a white man to get a job when the statistics don't even play that out, that this came out with statistics. Right. There's still by far 74%, something like that. I don't know exact stats, but stop it. And also this idea of the expectation that you have to give something up that is rightfully yours, as opposed to feeling like, oh my God, they caught me. I've been stealing for my entire life. It's a very different kind of response. I've been stealing from other people. I mean, it's not just, you know, how this all plays out. It's actually about the mortality rates of African Americans. You know, they're literally stealing people's lives. So yeah. I think it's fascinating to see how much horror is being done around African American horror and dealing with racism and racist. I mean, I'm fascinated watching right now Lovecraft Country, of course, the IP, the, you know, based on a book by author, but how what Jordan Peele and most importantly the showrunner Misha Green is doing is showing basically people of color have been living in a horror movie since, you know, the beginning of this nation, right? 1619 Project, you know, like lays that out. So it's just to me very is people have to now are facing that all of it is a lie. I remember teaching a course at UT called The Revolution Will Be Dramatized, and we're looking at plays and films for the most part about first the civil rights movement, then the Black Power movement, and then the final part was Black Lives Matter. And I had students who, this is a class I taught, oh, that made 6 years ago, had never heard of the Black Panthers. And pride in my class, because they realized the people that taught them, that they thought cared about them, K through 12, had been lying to them about the world. Mm-hmm. They'd given them an incomplete sense of it. And these are white students who were just devastated, never heard of Angela Davis, never heard of Malcolm X. And this is, you know, often I'm teaching something and deciding on a course, I'm thinking, oh gosh, they're gonna be like, oh God, this again. And looking at me like, and oh, what broke my heart. Broke my heart, because at the last part of the class, students are allowed to create a piece of their own about any movement that is important to them. So some people worked on gun violence, others worked on, some students worked on police abuse, whatever it is that you find, you know, some people dealt with food justice. And I had a trans student who was in the poem and just transitioning, and we had a conversation, and I said, well, you know, maybe to look at what's, you know, compare what's going on now with in terms of the trans and queer community and ACT UP. And that child had never heard of ACT UP.
Mm.
This is not ancient history.
No, not at all.
And so, and it's also information that this, you know, I say child, but, you know, I've gotten that point in my life where I'm that age. Like, these are, you know, children who like save this person's life. Literally knowing about ACT UP and the kinds of political organizing that happened. And so it's clear to me that folks are now realizing that they've been part of all of this themselves and have the willful, quote unquote, ignorance and their unwillingness to go toe-to-toe with Uncle George during Thanksgiving about some of these things has led to the deaths of people generationally. Oh, you know, and people talk about, oh my God, everybody's learning about Tulsa right now. I'm like, Tulsa's one. It's only one. Mm-hmm. There's so many others that have been written about that, you know, if you read, I teach in my Black Middle Class course, we begin in the beginning of the night of in 1900 with the book by Charles Chestnut, The Marrow of Tradition, which is about the Wilmington race riot. When you talk about race riot, it's about white people slaughtering black people. This whole idea of race riot about black people attacking, that's the big fear. It's also what's kind of part of underground, right? Underground in the country is underground fear of, oh my God, when they're going to do to us what we did to them, right? So that is something I really feel like the students learn from about the Black middle class from 1900 to the present, and look at how Black middle class has navigated racial terror And this novel, Marrow of Traditions, is brilliant one about a physician and mm-hmm. his family and how he just to figure out how he's going to support those who are trying to protect the Black community and what's going to happen to him and his family. So anyway, and it begins that how you have the Black middle class person as the, you know, this holier than thou figure. And that's changed over time, right? You know, to get the Black middle class seen as a sellout. And then now we're at a place where they're just another type of Black person as opposed to the best and the brightest, talented 10th idea of Du Bois or kind of the Oreo sellout beliefs that people had, like E. Franklin Frazier's mm-hmm. Black Bourgeoisie or something like that. So I love teaching that course. And because I've been teaching it since I was a graduate student, and it's don't teach it that often, but whenever I do, it's also clear to me that I'm oftentimes teaching students who are like myself, making when I was their age, making a class transition because of the educational opportunity. So I'm happy and proud to be at UT that has gone to the Supreme Court to maintain affirmative action policies. So that's I've been struck by how brilliant the students are. I called all of them when they graduate. I said, and now you're my mentor. And many of my graduate students have taken on that role, been very supportive of me, you know, because last time I was in New York, right before the world closed, I was meeting with my former undergraduate and graduate student and having lunch and talking about theater. And we, you know, go see theater together, talk about theater there. And I think that's the best way to mentor, is to understand that it's a give and take relationship. It's not just one way. There's things that they know that I do not, and I bring them my wisdom and they share theirs, and we will hopefully have a cross-generational conversations about how to finally be emancipated, because which was shocking for my Black friends as we were talking about all the food deliveries people were trying to make was that how we realized, oh my goodness, in order to survive this, there's so much I had to ignore. And I think that Monroe as a play shows what happens when you ignore this, ignore the horror, is that there is a price to pay psychologically. That's why I love the Pulitzer Prize winning play by Jackie Sibley's Drury, Fairview, about what it mm-hmm. means to live a life, because she's, I won't give it away, but what it means to live a life where you have to cede so much of your humanity so that you are not crushed by the institutions and the politics of the place that you and your ancestors have been in for so much time that you have nowhere else to, call home, really, and to make sense of this place. But it's... it's really striking. So I've definitely felt once since the 2016 election much bolder in my conversations with everyone that I deal with, and no longer sugarcoat racial issues. And that morning, I went dropped my son at school, and the white parents were talking. I said that's a conversation you should have with each other. And how do you feel? Even with the George Floyd, oh, you must feel terrible. I'm like, well, you must feel terrible. I mean, what? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do, but don't you feel terrible? Because that's done in your name and in protecting you and your world. And the fact that, don't you feel terrible that you didn't reach out when Trayvon Martin was killed? That you didn't find the words or the cookie recipe? and also talk to your white friends. That's who you should be going to and meeting with and white family members about what are you guys going to do about it? And Toni Morrison said that. It was a great quote she did on her interview with
is this the Juno Diaz one?
No. This is Toni Morrison in her interview with Charlie Rose.
Charlie Rose, yeah.
Yeah. About what are you going to do about it? You have a horrible problem. I mean, because the thing about it is like, what should we do? It's like, well, it's like my your child destroying the house, having a party and looking at you like, well, what should we do now? You destroyed the house. Clean the house up and fix it and don't do it anymore. I mean, it's like, it's a little, we want to have your kid comes to you and says, well, I had a party, destroyed the house. Can we get together a committee or a some kind of, group to advise me about what should be done now? Can you serve on that, actually? Can you run it, Mom? I mean, it's really, if you start walking it out, it shows us how ludicrous all of this. It's like, what are you asking? Talk to the whales about the ocean. The ocean is polluted now. What do you think we should, can we get together a group of whales to figure out? Come on. That's not going to be crazy. I mean,
Right. That's going to be my new favorite metaphor to describe that it's like asking whales to clean up the ocean. It's like asking black people to solve racism.
Well, maybe not because people, because then you're equating black people with animals and then we're in another.
Right. Okay. Yeah. good call there.
It's hard. They call it the crisis of analogy. It's hard to come up with analogy. So it's like you've done something wrong and you're asking someone else. If someone's done you a harm, would you ask them to help you figure out how to fix the harm? Identify the harm, figure out the solutions for it, and then not do it. That's the thing that was even better. I mean, don't forget, I have a good friend who was part of the President's Commission on Race, what Clinton had. That was, how many years ago was that? What came out of that? And it's going to take, the all the moms that are doing the brownie drive at the school, taking some of that energy that you're going to use to make sure you can hire special tech specialists for the neighborhood school, because you're using public funds to create a private school, right? All you have to do is have these fundraisers and then you get the extra stuff. Your families have enough money to do that. But you don't have to pay full tuition, right? You're paying $40,000 a year, but you donate $10,000 and you get to have your name on a banner outside. Thank you so much to the Suskin family for your contribution. We're so happy. You stand there at the assembly and, get out of here. Pshaw, pshaw, pshaw. No. I'm like, no, we're not doing that. So I'm fun to talk to. Can you imagine, the parents see me, they go the other way. They're like, oh my God, so-and-so's mom, run. She's here. Turn the lights off at the front office. They're like, turn off the lights. She's going to come talk to us. I can go on and on about this. But I think that'd be a good question, to – ask white people, why did you decide to have a bake sale in April 2020 instead of all the other times?
Now, I have one more question before we go, which you've touched on a bit, but I'd love for you to kind of elaborate on the relationship between your scholarly activity and your activity as a playwright, because you're not a professor of theater studies and also a playwright, which is more conventional, but you're a professor who's written, one scholarly book called Beyond the Black Lady, and you've also written many plays. How do you balance those two pursuits? I mean, it's like kind of like having two careers at once.
Thank you for acknowledging that. My dean is listening, I hope. And I'm actually writing at present. I'm actually trying to leave some breadcrumbs, gluten-free bread, for those who are coming behind me. And I'm writing finally writing my manifesto. People talk about having a, artist statement. But for me, it has to be a kind of a manifesto. I call it dancing on the slash. Choreographing the life as a black feminist artist scholar. I'm a black feminist artist and a scholar, and you're right, completely distinct. I studied modern thought and literature at Stanford, which is a great PhD program with basically in a little bit pretty much make your own PhD program. And in that, I decided to look at how black middle class women are represented in representing their sexuality in a variety of genres. So I looked at autobiography, I looked at film, fiction, as well as theater. And That was my dissertation. It became Beyond Black Lady, Sexuality in the New African-American Middle Class. And while I was in graduate school, I took a playwriting class, the only one I've ever taken, which was with Sheree Moraga. And that's where I actually read that class. I wrote Monroe, the first draft of Monroe. And then she thought it was so good that she wanted to invite me to join San Francisco theaters, have a playwriting group. So I started going to San Francisco, living near campus. I went back to the city of my birth and started doing these playwriting groups. And I was working on kind of these scenes of what it means to at the time of my life, navigating what it means to be a black middle class woman, black woman, who's smart and funny and gorgeous, and trying to figure out why am I still single then? What the hell's going on? So single black female was not called that at the time, but then I remember there was a Brava Theater was having wanted to do an afternoon of new plays in progress, and my writing partners were like, hey, you're going to be part of that? And I said, well, I can't do that. I'm sorry. I'm getting my PhD from Stanford, I have my oral examinations coming up. I can't possibly be involved with such folly. And they cursed me out. And I was like, okay, fine. So I remember going downtown to San Francisco to listen to the first read through of what I pulled together, vignettes.
Vignettes or scenes, yeah.
Yes. And I got down there and it was funny. And I was like, oh my God. So that was a Friday night. And there was the reading was on Sunday, and I went to the reading and people were cracking up, and Adele Prandini, who ran the Theater Rhinoceros in San Francisco, walked up to me and said, I want it for next season.
Wow. That was
the beginning of my career. So what couldn't go into the dissertation was in the plays, and vice versa. Right. And so they were born at the same time. And then I realized now, that's how I work, that I work on a question that's getting, that I'm trying to understand, and I try to articulate my answer through both theater and through scholarship. So I'm working on a book right now on how contemporary playwrights represent African-American history, just kind of flashpoint moments in Black history. And I have written my history plays, both Monroe and then Gold, and the final part of the Black Migration Trilogy, Flood, will all be my way of kind of thinking about this one thing about Black history, which is the Great Migration and how that migration to California and back down south, the remigration, which kind of follows the life of my family. My parents met in California, but they're both from different parts of Louisiana, and I'm now living in the South or South by Southwest, depends on who you're talking to. But I find it to be a very invigorating way of being in conversation with different audiences. So I love being in conversation with scholars, and I love being in conversation with audiences that come to see my plays or read my plays. And people who direct my work often say, she's always got some, symbols in the work that are from, that are scholarly things that, so it's slipping in the medicine, I guess, in a way that people don't necessarily taste it. So it's been a wonderful life that I've made for myself. I consider myself a rule breaker, and I was discouraged by different people along the way to, pick one. And I was blessed to have people who supported me, both my MA thesis director, Valerie Smith, who's now president of Swarthmore, and my former chair, my dissertation chair at Stanford, Harry J. Elam Jr., who's also an artist scholar. They both supported me being all of me. And now he's president of Occidental College. So I know how to pick mentors, but they're wonderful friends.
Either that or your influence on them is what enabled them to reach such academic
heights. Yeah, I doubt it. They were way on their way to being amazing people. I'm blessed to have people that of that stature look at me and be like, you can do whatever you want. And I remember single black female, Professor Elam, President Elam, came to the show and at the end looked at me and said, "You could have a career doing this too."
I feel like that faith in you is very much vindicated by this present volume. I enjoyed reading these plays so much. I hadn't been familiar with your work before I read them, but I was very moved, and I found them funny and provocative all at the same time. So thank you so much for the opportunity to read your plays and to interview you for New Books in Performing Arts.
Thank you so much, Andy. I've just had this has been one of my favorite interviews, and I really hope, now I got to write another book so I can talk to you again.
Thank you. Definitely be sure to let me know.